It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk about plastic pollution in the Great Lakes.
But first, an annual meeting of amateur aviators, the world's greatest aviation celebration.
We're talking about the EAA Air Venture. That's the Experimental Aircraft Association.
The week-long celebration happens each year in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
Here to tell us what to expect is EAA spokesperson Dick Napinski. Dick, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you so much. Happy to be with you this afternoon.
What is AirVenture?
Well, AirVenture, you mentioned it, is the world's greatest aviation celebration. It is officially the annual convention of our Experimental Aircraft Association, but it really becomes, I guess I would call it, aviation's family reunion, because no matter what people like to fly, what they like to see fly, and what they enjoy out on the flight line, it's here, and people come from more than 65 countries to be a part of it each year, and it really does make the world's largest general aviation gathering.
Experimental aircraft sounds like a lot of fun, maybe some UFO-type stuff. What are some of the more experimental things we see at this annual event?
Well, some of them truly are experimental. The Experimental Aircraft Association really came out of the category from the FAA. It's not a factory-built aircraft. It's one built by those who put it together themselves, whether from a set of plans or a kit. For instance, this year we're seeing a flying car from Terra Fugia out in Massachusetts. It flew on Monday, first time it'd flown at a public U.S. air show. Today we're seeing the first jet-powered human, a man named Yves Rossi from Switzerland. He's called Jetman, and he has a carbon fiber wing that has four small jet engines underneath it, and he'll drop from a helicopter, ignite those engines, and fly for about 10 minutes before parachuting to a landing. So those are just some of the things. Most of them are pretty much more conventional, your Cessnas, Beechcraft, and Piper aircraft, and some things, brand new corporate jets, different things coming across too, but the whole gamut is here in Oshkosh this week.
And so some people just do airplanes as a hobby, it sounds like.
They do. There are more than 30,000 home-built aircraft in the United States, fully inspected, fully registered, flown thousands of hours each year. And so you can build them from a kit or a set of plans and create something that you would not be able to buy off the factory floor, and something that's a lot less expensive, too.
I would be hesitant, well, first, to fly on that flying wing jumping out of a helicopter, or to fly in something that I personally put together. These people have some guts, it sounds like.
Well, it's not so much guts. It's really something that people enjoy doing. Most people who build aircraft are very experienced pilots. They've been flying for years, but yet they see a type of airplane that they can't find through the factory builds, or they see a design or something that they want to put together themselves. And, of course, the biggest thing is probably price. The basic four-seat airplane these days runs for about $200,000 or more, but if you take a look at some of the home-built aircraft, you can find a two-place aircraft that goes faster, is more fuel-efficient, and costs about $150,000 less once you get it completed.
How do people get into this? Is this something that is a family tradition for some folks, or is it just a unique type of hobbyist?
It's a little bit of both. Some people are part of an aviation family, three, four generations of aviators who have always been around the airport. Others are interested in flying for whatever captures their imagination about the world of flight. Most of us start in the basic small Cessna or Piper aircraft, learning how to fly, and then as our hours grow, our experience grows, and our knowledge grows about the entire world of aviation, then we start to explore other avenues. Is something such as home building for me? Is it something that you want to get into jet aircraft? Is it something that a person wants to start flying ultralights? All of those things become kind of a stepladder to more experience and more fun within the world of flight.
Does it happen that something we see at this event, something experimental today, in maybe a decade, we see it out on the runways of airports around the country?
Very much so. It's happened all the time. When you take a look at some of the current landing gear on small aircraft, when you look at the winglets, for instance, that are on commercial jetliners now, the little things that stick up in the air at the end of the wings, the winglets, that helps fuel efficiency on the big jets, that actually had its start in experimental aviation and home-built aviation. Designers looked at that, created a more efficient airflow over the wings, and created a better efficiency with their fuel as well. And eventually it worked its way into small jets and eventually big passenger jets, too.
I can't help but think of the Wright brothers when you're talking about the people who do this. Just a couple of guys, bicycle shop owners, tinkering and trying to make something fly where other people couldn't. Do you feel like there's that tradition, that history running through the event?
There really is. If you look back at the Wright brothers, they indeed were the first amateur home builders of aircraft, and they had the first successful one. And since then, it's built up through the years, mostly through the first couple of decades of flight. Everybody was a home builder, an experimenter. But then new designs come forward, and light aircraft, fast aircraft, and so forth, really got its start. Somebody taking an idea and exploring it, not so much in a corporate atmosphere, but exploring it with their own hand in mind, moving forward and trying to make something better all the way around.
So at the event this week, run us through a couple of the interesting things we might see if we check it out.
Well, we talked about Jetman this year. He'll be flying on Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, and Sunday. The flying car is scheduled to fly on Wednesday once again this year. People will see the world's only civilian-owned Harrier jump jet. It will be here flying during the air show. People will see some of the world's greatest aerobatic performers, and they will see some innovation, people who are working on new designs, things that may use inducted fans, may use unique wing designs, folding wing designs. Where is the world of aviation going next? They can talk to astronauts who will discuss the space program as it's been and what it's in the future. And they can have some fun, too, things such as Disney's brand-new airplane movie, Planes, which comes out August 9th, will be screened early, a week early, here at Oshkosh on August 2nd. So people who are captured by airplanes can have their imaginations captured by Disney and their look at airplanes as well.
I got to ask about the history. How did this event come to be in Oshkosh?
Well, it's always been a Wisconsin organization. EAA was founded, and you can probably hear airplanes in the background.
I was going
right
to ask, yeah.
As we speak. But it started in 1953 in Milwaukee. And the first fly-ins through the 1950s were in Milwaukee, and they eventually outgrew what's now Timmerman Airport. And then they moved down to Rockford throughout the 1960s. In 1969, it had outgrown its facility at Rockford, so at that point, they were looking for a new area. And the unique thing about Whitman Field here at Oshkosh is there are two long runways that don't cross. And since they don't cross, you can bring in a lot of airplanes and a lot of traffic, park cars and aircraft throughout the grounds. So it came to Oshkosh in 1970 and has been here ever since. And now Oshkosh is known around the world as a word in aviation. People come from more than 65 nations to be here.
I got to ask, I don't know if you're by a window, but what's buzzing around out there? What kind of plane are you seeing?
Right now, looking out over and trying to get a quick look, that appears to be a small aerobatic aircraft. I think it might be an extra or something like that, something that people can do a very rapid roll rate in, something as fast as 2 seconds, completely do a 360-degree roll. And so that's part of the air show here every afternoon, some of the world's best aerobatic pilots that fly here at Oshkosh.
I'm getting queasy just hearing about it. So I've been seeing planes, unusual planes, flying in and out of Madison here. Do we see planes staging in from around the state?
You really do. They use airports, not only staging, but some people park here in east central Wisconsin to be a part of it. They'll park hundreds of airplanes in Fond du Lac, in Appleton, places like Wautoma, New Holstein, Brennan Field outside Neenah, up in Green Bay, even down in Madison, will be a part of the entire event, and they'll commute up. And so more than 10,000 airplanes come to the area total to be a part of this event each year.
Dick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks so much.
That's Dick Nepinski. He's a spokesperson for the Experimental Aircraft Association.
Coming up, we'll hear about plastic pollution in the Great Lakes. Now, we've heard about plastic pollution going on in the oceans of the world, and now it turns out there's evidence that the same thing is happening in Great Lakes water. We'll get the scoop on that. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Turning our attention to the Great Lakes now, the lakes contain about one-fifth of the world's fresh water supply.
And preservation of all that fresh water has been a challenge. There's been industrial pollution, there has been algae and invasive mussels, and that's just naming a few of the challenges.
Well, now a group of chemists from universities in the Great Lakes region recently began testing the water for plastic as well. A report out today confirms that small particles of plastic are yet another challenge in preserving observing the lakes.
Here to talk about this is one of the chemists who've been involved in the study, Dr. Lorena Rios. She's an assistant professor of chemistry at UW-Superior. And Lorena, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, we've heard a lot of attention being focused in the past about plastics polluting the ocean. There's been the garbage island in the Pacific, which I guess is largely made up of plastic. What's the evidence that there's plastic pollution happening in the Great Lakes, too?
Yes, in the last year, we went to collect plastic samples to the Lake Superior, Huron, and Erie. And we find a lot of microplastic pellets in the Lake Erie, and this is a big problem because it's not the total amount of plastic that we find by weight, it's the amount in quantity. We find between 500 to 600,000 pieces per square kilometer. And the main problem with this very small plastic sizes is that it's easily accessible to the freshwater organisms. This means it's easily confused with natural food.
So in other words, fish could be eating it.
Yes, they can eat it. And the other big problem is that the plastic can absorb persistent organic pollutants that some of them are endocrine disruptors. And then we don't know what's going on with the when the fish eat this plastic with these pollutants and what happened when we eat this fish. This is the main problem.
So what kind of plastic are we talking about? Not all plastic is the same, right?
No, we have different kind of plastic, but the plastic that we found is we collected just in the surface water, and then this means need to be some plastic that is very similar in density to the water, and the mainly is polyethylene and polypropylene, and is the most common plastic used in our society.
Now, are these plastics that have any health risks that go along with them? Are they carcinogens, for instance?
Yes. That I analyzed in the plastic from the Lake Erie, I found the concentration in polyaromatic in double concentration that I found in the Atlantic Ocean.
Double the concentration is the plastic
double
in the Atlantic?
Double the concentration, yes. And the main problem, you know, we need to think always in the dilution factor. The ocean is so big and the Lake Erie is small and shallow, but still the concentration for the polyaromatic hydrocarbons is the double in concentration by gram.
Lorena, why are we first discovering this now? I've been hearing about plastic in oceans for years now. Why are we first hearing about it in the Great Lakes?
You know, the last year was the first time that we went to collect samples. I was working in the North Pacific Yard, and then when I moved here to Wisconsin, I said, you know, the plastic is everywhere, and then I need to know what's going on in the lakes, and we found it.
Now, this is also potential drinking water. The Great Lakes are often referred to, you know, it's one-fifth of the world's drinking water, something like that. Do I have that right? Yeah, one-fifth of the world's fresh water supply. So we need to care about what's in Great Lakes water. What do we do at this point?
I think we start just now with this research, and I know, for example, the problem that we found in the Lake Erie is the very small pellets, perfectly round pellets that we think maybe is from some beauty products.
From beauty products, I don't know. What would you find that in, like an exfoliating sort of product?
Yes, something like that, you know, because the sizes is, you need to use the microscope and then you can see it. This means it's very small, the size. And microplastic is defined by NOAA, whatever is plastic that is equal or smaller than 5 millimeters. And then we found some of them, and we find different fragments, different colors and sizes and shapes. But still, we're thinking that maybe it's from this very wrong pellet, the perfect pellets are from the beauty product. And you can see in the beauty products, you can read the labels, and you can read polypropylene or polyethylene. That is plastic. Yeah.
So how are cosmetics companies responding if we've gotten in touch and said, you know what, these plastic pellets are showing up in the Great Lakes? I suppose the first thing to do is to ask them to stop.
Yeah. Dr. Marcus Erickson from the Five Yards Institute started talking with the industry about this candy compounds, and some of them, they say that they will start to searching again to go back with the natural products, but this maybe take like a 5, 8, 7 years.
Years,
yeah.
I don't know. How do those numbers sound to you as a scientist who studies the Great Lakes? That sounds like a long time to me.
I know, but you know, the main point here is that we need to continue on doing the research, and then we need to find the facts and the real data and something like that that we can show to the people in power to do something, yes. And then for that, we need to do new researches about the implication, about this unclear consequence for the food chain by plastic ingestion by fish, for example.
Right, because a lot of anglers, I mean, that's a big tourism industry, too. It's not just a water supply. Anglers bring tourism and money to these regions around the Great Lakes. So I suppose that's key, is figuring out whether the fish are being affected.
Yes, I think now we need to add a new contaminant in the water, that is the plastic. And the main point here is to tell the people that we are the source. And then we need to stop to using plastic or reuse the plastic or refuse, recycle, do something with the plastic. Because if you don't see the plastic, it doesn't mean that this disappear, you know. Mm-hmm. We can find it in the Great Lakes or in the ocean.
Now, I understand you've specifically done testing on fish. You cut them open as part of your research. Do you see evidence of that plastic in the fish so far?
We opened already 120 samples from the Lake Superior, and just we find in 20 stomach, we find the very small fibers of plastic, not in a huge amount, but we found it. And we start to analyze now with the fish, the intestine, and the stomach from the Lake Erie. And we opened already 20, and we don't see any. But I'm sure we find it from the Lake Erie. We can find plastic. Because, you know, the concentration of the amount of plastic, microplastic in the Lake Erie is huge.
So essentially you're saying if you're seeing it in the fish, odds are, you know, we're eating it if we're eating those fish.
Yeah. But we need to study more to see what is the transfer of these pollutants to the organisms and what's going on with the organisms. See, the problem is stop in the fish or the problem go with us when we eat at the fish.
Now, you mentioned Lake Erie, and that's where you've done a lot of your work. Is it possible that the pollution looks worse than it is because you're using Lake Erie's water? Don't the other lakes empty into Lake Erie?
You know, I've seen the main situation is all the people around to the Lake Erie. The second is that we can see is the very small lake and shallow, and we can see how the water from the other lakes, Superior, Michigan, and Huron, go to the Lake Erie.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe this is one source. We don't know yet. And in this August, I will go to collect samples in the Lake Michigan, Huron, and the river, St. Clair River. And I hope so I can go to the Erie again. And then we can see. We need to continue with this research, taking samples to see complete the picture about the plastic pollution in the Great Lakes.
So if there is this pollution building up in the lakes, how long would it take to clear up pollution like that?
Oh, I really don't know, because in the sizes that we have, I'm talking the microplastic, that is the worst plastic. I really don't know. I don't know if we really can clean.
We're still in the beginning phases, sounds like.
Yes.
So, given what we know about how long there's been awareness about plastic pollution in the oceans, now we're finding it in the Great Lakes. How do you feel about the chances for addressing this possible pollution, or that we found the pollution? How do you feel about the chances of addressing it quickly and addressing it carefully and well?
I think we are doing a really good job, you know, because this the plastic problem is coming from 1970s, when the first researchers, they started saying, you know, hey, look at this, there is plastic, the reproduction pellets, we can find it in the ocean. But it's like, oh, it's okay, the plastic don't do anything, it's no big deal. But then in 1992, it's again when the West reported in the North Pacific Jar that the concentration in the plastic is 6 to 1. This means 6 kilos of plastic against 1 kilo.
And Dr. Lorena, I'm so sorry, but we have to leave it there. But thank you so much for talking about this with us today. Appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
That was Dr. Lorena Rios, Assistant Professor of Chemistry at UW-Superior. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. As Americans get older, assisted living has become a booming industry.
And it's expected to grow as baby boomers enter the market more and more.
In the Frontline documentary, Life and Death in Assisted Living, ProPublica reporter A.C. Thompson reports on the state of assisted living in the U.S. Here's a clip.
We're creating an industry with a million people in it who are becoming more frail, who are poorly regulated by the state. I mean, that's why I talk about it as a ticking time bomb, because we're going to see more deaths, more injuries, and families are going to be so shocked because they think they've made a good decision. They think they've made a safe decision.
The documentary premieres tonight on PBS stations and online. You can catch it at 9 tonight on Wisconsin Public Television, and ProPublica is publishing a series online throughout the week. A.C. Thompson is the producer of that. He is a correspondent for Frontline and a reporter for ProPublica. He joins us now. A.C., welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, let's talk about what assisted living is, because watching the documentary, it seems like a lot of people conflate it with nursing homes or nursing care. It's something different, right?
Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing people always get confused about, and I always have to explain to them. It took me a while to figure out. So the best way to think about it is to think about senior housing as a continuum, right? There's people that are living on their own, that are doing their own thing, and then there's people who are in nursing homes who need around-the-clock medical attention. They need trained medical personnel to make sure that they are okay. In the middle is assisted living, and it's kind of a middle spot. And the idea is to provide people with housing that's safe, that's secure, and where there is some supervision and there is some folks around who can make sure that you get fed, that you take your medication on time, that you don't have something bad happen to you, like a serious fall. But at the same time, it's supposed to be more home-like, more like an apartment. You can have your friends over. You can, in some cases, have a pet there. You can have your own furniture. And that's what assisted living is.
And the concept is that it is non-medical, right?
Right. Exactly. And so that was an original kind of founding principle, that this was going to be a non-medical model, a social model. And it was kind of, the idea was, look, this is senior housing with services. But what's evolved over time, what's changed, is that in time we've seen from the two big national studies done on the subject, the people who are living in these facilities are increasingly very ill or have serious physical limitations or have serious cognitive impairment, serious dementia or Alzheimer's. And so what you're seeing is more and more people in these facilities who actually have very serious health needs.
And is the staff, are the staffs at the for-profit assisted living homes that you looked at, are they ready for those needs?
You know, well, it varies massively across the country, and it varies from company to company. We spent a lot of time looking at the industry as a whole and a lot of time looking at the number one player in the industry, and that's the Emeritus Corporation based in Seattle, Washington. And I think what was worrisome to us with Emeritus, which operates about 500 facilities across the country, was that over and over and over again, we found people were paying $4,000 or $5,000 or more to live in their facilities, and then the staff in these facilities were lacking the legally required training that states insist workers have. We saw it repeatedly in state after state, in facility after facility.
$4,000 or $5,000
per month.
Per month.
Yeah. To clarify, so people are, and that's out of pocket. That's not typically not insurance money. So people are shelling out a lot of money.
Well, we'll get into some of the problems you encountered, but how does regulation of these assisted living facilities compare, say, to what we expect in nursing homes?
No, it's dramatically different, and that's partly because this started out as a non-medical space, right? It's the social model. And so the regulation has always been greatly reduced from what you see in nursing homes. Part of that is also because in nursing homes, they overwhelmingly accept money from the federal government, Medicare, Medicaid. So the federal government comes in and they say, hey, if you want our money, you need to adhere to our guidelines. And our guidelines include things like you need to document in great detail what happens with every person that comes in your doors. You get to assisted living, there's very little federal money in there. There's some Medicaid money in some states that people use to pay for it, but overwhelmingly people just pay out of their bank account. So the federal government has stayed out of it. And as a result, assisted living is basically a black box. We don't know on a national basis what is going on in these facilities. We don't know what kind of meds people are taking. We don't know what kind of poor outcomes they're having. We don't know what kind of positive outcomes they're having. So it's just there's a much lower level of data and information for assisted living. And I think that means that it's hard for us to make good policy choices, and it's also hard for consumers to make good choices.
Well, why don't you tell stories of, sad stories, I will say, of some of the people who went into these assisted living facilities. One you tell toward the beginning of the documentary is about George McAfee. Can you tell his story?
Yeah, you know, when we came across the George McAfee story, we were really astounded. We were really, really blown away. George McAfee was an NFL Hall of Famer. He was a very famous football player in the 40s and very early 50s. Played for the Chicago Bears, was a star running back, served the United States of America in World War II, interrupted his football career to do that. And when he was older, later in life, he developed dementia. When his daughters felt, hey, you know, we just can't take care of Daddy anymore. We can't be sure that he'll be okay living on his own. They helped him move into a senior care facility and then eventually into an emeritus facility in Georgia. When George moved into that facility, it was owned by a different company. About a year later, Emeritus bought it. And the daughters say that things changed when Emeritus came along, that they found that their father was dirty, that he wasn't bathed, that he wasn't, his clothes weren't changed, that his sheets were dirty. And they said, you know, we were concerned at that point. But things went very dramatically wrong one night when what we know from the records from the investigation is that there was no worker on duty in George's wing of the building for about 25 minutes. Sometime that night, he wandered out of his room and drank a bottle of toxic dishwashing liquid that had been left out in the facility kitchen. That dishwashing liquid burned his lips, burned his esophagus, burned his lungs, and eventually those burns killed him, chemical burns. You know, I think perhaps what's most shocking about George's death is the state of Georgia came in and they said, this is an outrage, we're really upset about this, it shouldn't have happened, and we're going to fine you $601. And in fact, that fine isn't just for George's death, it's also for this other person who had a medication error in the facility. So not even $600 for Mr. McAfee's death. And I think that was the thing that was most shocking to us at that point.
You talked to representatives of the company about that case and others. What is their response when you bring up something like this?
You know, the company is will tell you that they're very sorry about those incidents. Like that one where there's been a state finding, where there's been a lawsuit that's been settled. They'll say, we're very sorry. It was horrible. It was a tragedy. And they also say, these are isolated incidents. We're picking on this company for a handful of isolated incidents, and we shouldn't be doing that. They provide really good care to people day in, day out. Yes, they occasionally make mistakes. That's what humans do. They make mistakes. But overwhelmingly, they provide very good care to people.
Well, and there's the point that these are not nursing homes. These are, you know, this could have happened to someone living in their own home. This isn't really supposed to be taking care of someone with really bad dementia. What's the answer there?
Well, you know, there's kind of a few issues there. And so one of them is the question about, well, you know, if you're in an assisted living facility, which is kind of like being at home, it's kind of like an apartment, but you've also got some folks around helping you, should you expect a better level of care than you would get at home? My sense is that if you're paying $4,000 or $5,000 or more a month for care, you should probably get better care than someone who doesn't know about Alzheimer's, doesn't know about the needs of seniors would provide you at home. That's my personal opinion. And yeah, it's not always going to be perfect, but I think you should have higher expectations when you're spending that kind of money. The sort of next thing is that with this evolution of the population in these facilities, what we've seen is, okay, so now today we have more and more people with Alzheimer's, other forms of dementia. We have more and more people that have real serious needs, like they can't dress themselves, like they need help going to the toilet, like they need help eating. These are serious needs that people have. Have the regulations, has the oversight of the state kept up with this change in the population? And I'm not sure that it has. For example, where I live in the state of California, you know, I could run a facility after getting 40 hours of training, a week-long training. Now, I don't have any background in medicine. I don't have any background in social work. I personally think I'm a pretty nice guy, but I don't think I would be competent to look after a decent number of people with those kind of problems, because frankly, I don't think in a week I would learn enough. I could be wrong, but I just don't think so.
We're talking to A.C. Thompson, ProPublica reporter, producer of the Frontline documentary Life and Death in Assisted Living. You can see that tonight on Wisconsin Public Television at 9 o'clock.
And we'd love to hear what you think about this. Is someone in your family in assisted living, or do you work at an assisted living facility? What has been your experience so far? Share it with us at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or send your email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Talking to A.C. Thompson about the new documentary, Life and Death in Assisted Living. It's a Frontline piece, and you can see it tonight at 9 on Wisconsin Public Television. Looking at the assisted living industry, do the workers get enough training? Does the profit motive affect the quality of care? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you have an experience in assisted living you'd like to share, maybe you have a relative there and you're pleased with the experience, you're not, maybe you work in the industry, give a call. AC, before we get to our callers, you in the documentary talked to some people who had tried to raise some of these concerns within the industry. What did you hear from them?
You know, one thing that we were hearing was from people that worked for the Emeritus Corporation who said, you know, I raised concerns with my bosses. I took it to the people all the way at the top of the company. I called the company's ethics line. And what we found in case after case was these people either wound up quitting the company because they felt that they couldn't make improvements, or they wound up being fired. And the company often said, well, they weren't very good workers, they weren't competent. But I think it's important to point out, you know, we followed very closely a trial that unfolded for a year in, or a case that unfolded, we followed it for a year in Northern California. And in that case, the judge heard a lot of this evidence that we heard as well in our interviews and said, you know, in a ruling, I have heard a lot of evidence that suggests that people who raised complaints and raised concerns within this company lost their jobs.
You also spoke to families of people involved in the McAfee sad story that you told earlier, the one in California you were just referencing. What kind of things did you hear from families who had brought their relatives to these facilities?
You know, and one thing that we heard was a lot of people were happy, and a lot of people felt like, you know, this is a good alternative. It's worked out well, and it's been a really good thing for our family to have a loved one in assisted living. I should make that absolutely clear. One thing that we also heard, though, was we heard a lot of the same kind of stories, and that's what worried us. We heard a lot of stories about residents with dementia wandering off from these facilities and sometimes dying. One woman froze to death on Christmas morning in the parking lot of an emeritus facility. We heard a lot of stories about something that totally surprised us, about residents with dementia and Alzheimer's attacking one another and sometimes injuring each other fatally. Like, we heard that story in Pennsylvania, in Colorado, in Texas. We heard about a woman in California who received 100 stitches as a result of an altercation. We had no idea this was going on. We didn't know. We heard a lot of stories involving people who apparently had serious falls and died as a result. And sometimes, sometimes folks who are older and have health problems, you just cannot prevent them from falling. But sometimes you wonder if this is a problem with poor supervision. Sometimes the states have said, hey, you know, you need to do more to make sure that this gentleman who perished in your facility, that people like him don't back their wheelchairs down the stairs like happened in one emeritus facility in California. So we heard a lot of similar stories.
We'll go to our callers now. We have Mary on the line in Madison. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I agree with a lot of what your guest says. I work for a hospice organization, so I'm in and out of many kinds of facilities. Some assisted livings are great, especially often the smaller ones where they really get to know their people. But I do think because of the economic downturn, there are many facilities now that are not full. They have empty rooms, empty beds. And so they will take people who really are too seriously ill or too much dementia to be there just to fill up their rooms. And then some of these other problems you mentioned are occurring. So that's my comment.
Mary, thank you so much. AC, is that something that you're seeing?
Yeah, it's really interesting to hear that from somebody like her who's in and out of these buildings, because that's a thing that we've seen a lot. And what we've heard about is the internal mechanics of the industry, the pressure by the people who work in these buildings to move in residents day after day, fill up the buildings, hit the highest possible occupancy numbers. And what one executive, former executive for Maris, told us is, you know, there's this problem where with that pressure, the line between who should move in and who shouldn't move in gets blurry, then it gets blurrier, and then it disappears altogether. And then you're moving in people who should not be in these facilities.
Mary, thanks for the call. We'll go now to Lori in Tomahawk. Lori, hi.
Hi. I've had experience as a case manager for developmentally disabled, and also have had numerous family members in both assisted living and in nursing homes. And it's a complicated issue, but it has to do with training, it has to do with regulations, but also it has to do with family involvement with the person directly and very intensive involvement so that the family can insist on good quality care.
Thank you so much for calling, Lori. So families need to get in there and advocate, AC.
You know, early in this project, I spent time driving around with an ambulance driver who goes to assisted living facilities and nursing homes. Because when people have injuries or fall or get ill, he's the one that picks them up. And he said that was absolutely, on an anecdotal basis, that one of the biggest indicators was whether a person had family visiting them frequently or not, as to whether they would get good care or not. Family comes in regularly, you are more likely to get decent care. And that was his anecdotal take, but everyone I talked to believes that to be the case.
But when you make the decision to get somebody into an assisted living facility and are paying thousands of dollars a month, is there an assumption that it's probably quality, the government's watching over it, so maybe people don't even go in thinking about that idea of being advocates?
I think that's definitely the case. You know, and these facilities, the big chain facilities, a lot of them are very, very nice. You know, we're not talking about dumpy dives. We're talking about nice facilities, nice carpet, nice furniture, you know, no peeling paint, well-manicured lawns. And what you don't see sometimes is that there's a skeleton crew on duty. There's very few people on the night shift, which happens to be a time that a lot of seniors need to get up, go to the bathroom, get a drink, and sometimes have falls or sometimes need help. And you don't see that. You see a nice facade. You see a nice building. People often don't realize what's going on. And I should put it in perspective some, too. You know, we met a woman in Mississippi whose mother was in assisted living, is now in a nursing home, and she has no job. This woman spends every day going to see her mother and caring for her mother, and she's done that for 4 years, even though she's in a nursing home, because she feels she has to be involved. That's a massive time commitment. A lot of people can't make that kind of time and life commitment. They just can't, because they have to go out and do their 40 hours to get paid.
Thanks for the call, Lori. We'll go to Ryan in Kewaunee now. Hi, Ryan.
Hi. Yes, I'd like to say I don't know all the regulations and everything to being hired for working in one of these places, but I have some offset family members that work in these places, and they must not get drug tested and or criminal background checks, because they both, they mean if they were, they would, neither one of them would be working in these facilities, and they've worked in them for quite a long time. And I'm just, I was more curious, I guess, to know what the qualifications are to get into those places, or can just kind of anybody.
AC?
That's a great question. So here's how it goes. You know, just about every state has a criminal background check law that says, hey, you know, you gotta check this person out before they come work there. Most states have rules around infectious diseases. You gotta get tested for TB before you start working at one of these places. But what we kept finding was those were things that often fell by the wayside. Criminal background check, TB testing, and other sort of health testing, often these are things that don't get done. And especially facilities and companies that have high turnover, where people are coming in constantly, you need to constantly hire new people. We found a lot of that, of a failure to do criminal background checks. I can actually, it goes like this. In our initial review of four states for their inspection records, we found about 53 violations of criminal background laws in four states.
All right, that's all we have time for. But AC, thanks so much for joining us today. And it sounds like there might be another documentary on how we deal with aging people with Alzheimer's and where they end up. It sounds like that's a big unsolved problem lurking beneath this.
Absolutely. I absolutely think that should happen.
AC Thompson has been with us. He's ProPublica reporter, producer of the new Frontline documentary, Life and Death in Assisted Living. You could see it tonight on Wisconsin Public Television at 9 o'clock.
The news is coming up next, and when we come back, we'll talk to a guest who says there are not enough people to fill agricultural jobs in Wisconsin, and take a look at what that means for the future. And don't forget, you can keep up with us on the Central Time Facebook page. You can comment on what you just heard or leave a comment about a previous day, leave an idea, something that's been on your mind. Just go to Central Time on Facebook. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.